This is Sylvia Busis and Eleanor Mermelstein for the Oral History 2 project of the National Council of Jewish Women, Pittsburgh chapter, starting an interview with Mr. Harry Katz. Harry, your address is?
302 Frazier Drive, Wilkins Township, Pittsburgh, PA 15235.
Thank you. Okay, Harry, this, by the way, is June 18th, 1984. We've been wanting to get together with you this whole winter while you were back and forth from Florida because we know that you really have so many interesting facets of your life that you've done that we think would be of great value sometime to someone who is delving into the history of the Jewish people in Pittsburgh. Let's talk first about a little bit about your family background, your parents and your siblings.
Okay. Well, my father was born in Poland. He became an orphan at age 16, and he spent the next 10 years of his life wandering around from one yeshiva to another. On his own, living one day a week here, one day a week there, one of these tegger people, and he slept on a bench in a shul. His hometown was Slonim, and he lived in Grodno Gubernia, and he attended, among other yeshivas, the Slobodka Yeshiva in Kovna, Lithuania, and the Rosh Yeshiva was Reb Sheptel, who was the grandfather of Litvinov, the great communist politician. He came into this country in 1893 at age 17 by himself, and his name was really not Katz. His name was Lobzovsky. And how did he get the name Katz? It's interesting.
What was his first name, by the way?
His real name is Yitzchok Isaac Ben Zev Lobzovsky. His name should have been Isaac, but he was known as Jake Katz, and here's the reason. When he was able, at age 17, he wanted to leave to escape going into the army. He had enough money to get as far as England, and he's on the dock and wondering where am I going to go from here. And he came across a family that was having a big argument. The ship was there, the father and the children and mother all got on the boat, but the oldest son said no, he's not going to go, and the father was pleading with him, and finally the boy went away, and my father went over to the father and said, if he's not going, your ticket is wasted. Let me have it. I have no way to get here. So the father was mad at the son, so he gave it to this the young kid. And the name on the ticket was Jake Katz. So he thought he would escape the police coming after him, and he thought he got a free ride. So he came here, and he changed his name to what it was on the ticket. When his brother came, and his mother and his sister, they all changed their name to fit him because he sent for them. So our name is not Katz, and we're not Cohens, you know,
right.
Sons of Aaron. And our real name should have been Lobzovsky or Loeb or something like that. So he came to Baltimore, and he got swept up with Americanism, with the American system. And there was an election going on at that time for Williams Jennings Bryan, 1896. And he was really excited about it. And he spoke in Yiddish to the Jewish people there, got on a soapbox, and he was a real hot Democrat. And to this day, we're all Democrats because father was a Democrat. So there aren't too many people whose tradition of being dedicated Democrats are as strong as ours that came from my father. He left Baltimore, and he went to Washington, D.C. And when he was there, he got a job in a newsstand near the capital. And he was able to get into, make friends and conversation with great people of the day, senators and judges. And he used to spend long hours talking to Admiral Schley, who was a great admiral in the Spanish-American War. And he talked with Langley at great length. And Langley was the head of the Smithsonian Institute. And he used to invite him to come over to the Smithsonian and continue the conversation, because Dad was a student, Talmudist, and a student of politics, and Langley was a hungry man for all kinds of information. In those years, the head of a Smithsonian or any institution was an expert at everything. He was an entomologist, he was everything, botanist. And so one of the things that he was doing when my father was talking with him was working on some kind of a flying machine. And he was complaining to my dad about how these two bicycle mechanics were taking so much of his time. And he was bending the tubes and fixing things up so he should make a machine that would fly, while he was talking to my dad about religion and everything else. And so later on, a year or two, it wasn't very long after that, the Wright brothers flew the first plane. Somebody went back a year later to look at the machine that Langley was working on, and they twisted a tube just a little 5 degrees more, and it flew. So the first person who really should have got the credit for flying was not Wright brothers, but Langley. And he was doing that while my father was talking with him about politics. He came to Pittsburgh about 1903 or 1904, and he started a furniture store in Southside.
What brought him to Pittsburgh, Harry?
He got married when he was a very young man, and his wife came from the Landau family, who were woolen people. They were wealthy people, apparently. So I don't know where he met her or how, but it was a bad marriage. And they went back to Pittsburgh, and he started this store.
Oh, her family was from Pittsburgh?
Her family was from Pittsburgh, Landau woolen people. I never met them at all. And he had two children.
What was her name?
I don't know her first name, but they had two children, and one of the children's name was Goldie. And Goldie married Froy Nathan, and he was involved in Truman's Day as one of the influence peddlers or something, a little slight scam. He was a gambler, a professional gambler, a nice fella, but he made his living gambling. I never met him or knew him at all. People older than me, a lot of them must know Froy Nathan. And Goldie, the daughter, I never met her, but there are people here who know her, and I she's dead, I'm sure, a long time ago. I don't know how long ago, but I've never been able, and I always wanted to meet with them, but for one reason or other, we couldn't. Anyway, he got a divorce. In those years, it was difficult to get a divorce, and he got a legal gift. And I remember hearing stories about how Rabbi Zivitz gave it, and he was the strictest rabbi of all. Anyway, he wanted to get away from it as far as he could, from that whole scene. And he had a very successful store in the south side of Pittsburgh in Carson Street. And he sold secondhand furniture, and he made a lot of money, and he was wealthy.
What did he call that store?
Don't remember the name. I don't know. Okay. Anyway, one of the stories I remember about that is that they had a potbelly stove in the back. In those years, that's the way it worked. And one of the people who used to spend the winters there with nothing else to do except talk was Honus Wagner, the great football hero.
Oh, my.
And there was a little young fellow, about 15 or 16, that had a drawing. My father looked at it and he loved it. He said, let me put it in the window. And he put it in, and it wasn't long before it was sold. And there came another drawing, sold it again. The boy's name was Jim Nesbert. Jim Nesbert had a brother, a younger brother, Vincent Nesbert, and he started the Pittsburgh Art Institute. He was one of the great Pittsburgh-born artists. He's known among the art people. They know all about Vince Nesbert. He's more famous than his brother, Jim. One of the pictures that Jim painted was my grandmother, and I have it on the wall there, and I'll show it to you before we leave. It's an oil painting. And so my father wanted to leave Pittsburgh, and he, as far away as he could go, and at that time, that was Cannonsburg, a streetcar took an hour, and nobody went out there, so he was safe out here. So he opened up a furniture store, and it was full of all kinds of good merchandise down in the east end of town, and he was doing very good, and then that's when he met my mother, and her father was a Lubavitcher. His name was Henoch Horvitz, and he was impressed with the learning that my father had, and my mother was not a well person. She had polio when she was 3 years old, and one foot was much shorter than the other, and she hobbled all the time. And they got married, and they moved to Cannonsburg. And
what year was that, Harry?
1911. Mm-hmm. And it looked very good. And then in 1912, a big flood came and destroyed my father's business. Everything was destroyed. The water came in, and all the sofas and tables and everything floated out of the, gone. And he never got on his feet after that. He started a 5 and 10, and that was new and novel, and he did very good, and he was selling everything that was 5 cents or 10 cents, and that was more like a hardware business, and tacks and nails and things like that. In those years, lots of things were 5 and 10 cents. But the big chains started to come in with their tremendous buying power, and they couldn't ever make a living again after that. So he had a lot of trouble making a living in Cannonsburg. And we barely got by, and mother had 4 sons. I was the oldest.
Did you ever give us your mother's first name?
Fanny.
Fanny.
Fanny. And Faggy Nesha. She was a beautiful person. Had a voice, should have been trained in a school, because an opera singer, and she used to love to go to operas down where they had the exposition hall. She knew every opera, and she just followed them very carefully. She was a tremendous person. She was the kind of a person that all the neighbors respected, and if anybody ever had an argument and a fight, they always said, let's go and let Fanny solve it. And she was the peacemaker of the whole community all the time. There was nobody that she had a bad word for, and nobody that she that didn't consider her a friend. Our doors were always open, and there was never a time that people didn't walk in every time they needed help. Sadako, it was an intensely Lubavitcher family. A real religious life. She was, and yet she never told us anything about what to do or not to do, not to go to shul, not to go to shul, or what to do. Left it us on our own, very tolerant of how we did. Now, the reason I'm mentioning that is because my father, even though he was a Talmud Chochem, even though he went through the Gemara, the whole Shas, 7 times, and was an expert, wherever he went, they considered him like a rabbi. They came to him for advice, and he knew it inside and out. He had a sponge of a mind for that sort of thing. When he was in Washington, D.C., and he was meeting with all of these great people, Langley and others, one of the persons he met was a fellow by the name of Ingersoll, George Ingersoll. If you don't know it, George Ingersoll was the father of Gnosticism, a freethinker. And among the many books that we have is not only books when I grew up with, was not only books with the Chumash and the very, very good library of Jewish subjects, but also these things that had to do with disbelief. Proof that the Bible was a fairy tale. Proof of, that's what I grew up with. And I was very much disturbed when I was 13, 14, 15 because I was reading all that stuff. But despite all that, when we all went in the army and all four of us were in war, none of us ate treif. When my brother Dave, the youngest...
Excuse me, do you want to just go down through...
my genealogy?
Yeah, I mean, your birth date and your
all
brother's...
Right. I was born on May 25th, 1915. And my second brother was born... Right. Bill.
Bill.
Was born on June of 1917. And the third boy came along, Alvin... And he was born in April of 1920. And the youngest that they hoped would be a girl was brother Dave, the dentist. And he was born in September of 1922. So there was no girls. The four boys grew up. And when we went to the army, Dave was in the Battle of the Bulge. Couldn't be a worse place where most of the people there were killed. He was one of the lucky, didn't even get a scratch. And when they're in the trenches and they're exchanging K rations, he would give them their meat for their fish, for their cheese, which nobody wanted cheese. But even in the trenches, in the Battle of the Bulge, my mother's influence was that strong. And she never once said, eat kosher or go to shul or like tefillin or what. And all of us like tefillin. We're not Shomer Shabbos, but we have a very strong attitude that favors people who do, or that environment which allows that sort of religious observance to go on. And so just illustrates who won out between the philosophy of my mother, plus my father, and they never argued, never fought. When they had Pesach, Papa put on a Seder, the whole thing. But on Saturday, Mama didn't work, and it was a house that was totally Jewish. And to this day, it carries on with our children, all of us. And that's the reason why the synagogue was built here. No other reason. The strength to make these things and stick with it and stay with it came. Zadie started a synagogue, the Lubavitcher Synagogue on Aaron Street, back before World War I. The cemetery, he started it, the Lubavitcher Cemetery, and was very, very active in that whole community.
Where is that cemetery?
In Millville, Ohev Tzedek was the one that he started, and it was a breakaway from the other shul. The Weiners were running it, and he didn't like the way he ran it, and so he started this other one, and it's a small shul. That's where my mother and father and my son is buried there, and it's a nice little cemetery. It was taken over by B'nai Amuno.
Oh.
And that's who owns it now. But it was a...
Now, your grandfather founded that.
He started.
Did he come over after your father did?
My grandfather means my mother's father.
I see.
My father's father died when he was 6 years old. He saw very little of him. My mother's... father and mother came in 1903 with the whole family, and you would be interested in knowing who they were. The oldest was my mother, Fanny, and next came Morris, and Morris Horvitz. He died in 1942. His son, he had only one daughter, And that was, why can't I think of her name now? Just on tip of my tongue. She's in California. It'll come to me. And then the next child was Esther. She married Oakland. And then came Dave Horvitz, an auto dealer. He's a fellow who started Hillel Academy in his garage in the Morrowfield during World War II. He had an empty garage, and he started for 2 years. That was where the classrooms were, and he really founded that. And then the next child was Bess. She married a fellow named Winograd, and their oldest son is Rabbi Winograd from Keysport. And their second daughter is Selma. She married Ruby Cohen. He's very active in the Beth Shalom. He's an accountant. And then their youngest son is Kenny. He's a fellow who is widely quoted and did all the research on the people without homes, the bag women and so forth, recently. He's a sociologist of great note.
So these people were your...
These are all my mother's family. My mother was the oldest, then came...
These are your aunts and uncles.
Aunts
then.
And uncles, yeah. Mm-hmm. After that came Sam Horvitz. He was the first one that was born in this country. All the rest were born in Chadrin, the little town where my mother was born in. And Sam had four sons, and they owned the Pool City. That's Bobby Horvitz and Lee Horvitz. Lee married the daughter of the Shamus and Beth Shalom. I think of his name. It was one of these days when I'm losing important names right on the tip of my tongue. And the youngest daughter was Belle. She married Alex Portnoy. And their daughter married the Falader boy from the Stones, you know, the Falader.
From the Monument.
Monument. Mm-hmm. So she is very active in the Hillel. She's a secretary, and she does quite a lot. So in general, the children from Hena Horvitz have done real well for the Jewish community in many ways. For instance, Sam Horvitz's oldest son, Lee, has been extremely active in Jews for Soviet Jewry, and he's an activist in many ways. And my brother Al, his daughter, is very active now with the Jews from Ethiopia, the Falashes. He's probably one of the very few who's out making speeches and trying to help them. And brother Dave has been president of Bethel, very active in their organization, extremely so. And my uncle Dave Horvitz started the YMHA in Chicago back in the 20s. This family is a family of doers. I might want to mention about where my mother came from. In this little town of Chadrin is a little village, was a little village that was started in 1842 by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who went to a prince in Russia by the name of Shedrinov and made a proposition: if we sell us this 1,000 acres or whatever, we will name a town after you. And he went to a lumber dealer in Bobroisk by the name of Holodets and got the money, and he cut half of the the forest to make a village, and the other half, and the trees that he cut off were for making barns and houses, and the other he cut down to sell to pay it back. And the Lubavitcher went around all over Russia, mostly around there, but he went far away, and he picked 300 families, people who were very religious and very good with their hands. And he was able to get the government of Russia to consider these people as citizens, and that was a very rare thing. And when I was talking with my uncle Sam Oakland, he told me how he prized that little slip of paper that he had, that he was a citizen of Russia, because Jews were not citizens. They were dogs. They couldn't go to court for anything. I mean, this is all the Jews were that way. And this very small group of privileged Jews, for this very special reason, were considered citizens of Russia. They could do what other citizens. They could go to court and were recognized. So why did this all come about? When my son was in Boston, he was starting to get interested in religious things. He came across some information about Chedrin as being a hotbed of the Lubavitcher movement. And he sent me a map that he got in Clark University, and he asked me to see what I could find out about it. So I sent out 50 postcards to my relatives, people from Chedrin, to see if I couldn't find out from them. And we're going to have a gathering. And how many people came? 200 people. They were so hungry for this information.
What year was this?
This was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago. Now I have a list of 250 names all over the United States and in Israel. And they were sending out a notice. Tomorrow I'm sending it out. I have mountains of literature in which I have family trees that are this thick, and it's a big job I have ahead of me. One of the people who helped me an awful lot to find out some of these things was Neil Buses. That's his hobby also.
Right.
And one of the things that's happening is that people are writing me if I knew where so-and-so is. And every year I'm putting together families.
You're a whole organization unto yourself, Harry.
From this Chedrin group. And I'm running into the most unbelievable stories. And last week I found out in the Wall Street Journal there's a woman, a 92-year-old woman who's a furniture dealer in Des Moines. She is a Chedrinner. I'm going to write to her.
Was that mentioned in the Wall Street
Journal? No, I just happen to know that she is a Chedrinner. It's where she came from.
Oh, my goodness.
And the influence of Chedrinners is so profound all over the world, you can't believe it, in science and medicine and everything.
From 300 hand-picked families?
300 hand-picked families, what they caused and what they did, and the amount of Jewishness that they brought, intense Jewishness, was really remarkable.
I think that we're at the end of this tape, and I don't want to interrupt your thoughts, so maybe we'll cut it here and turn over. I think we can just stop it here.
This.
It's just easier than interrupting you in the middle of a sentence.
All right.
Harry, you are the person in this decade who has really assumed the leadership role in this particular Landsmannschaft.
Yes.
I guess it's a...
That's a good word. That's what it is.
It's a period of time when some of them are really dying out, but this has renewed interest, really.
Uh-huh. And you know who's interested? Not the old-timers so much. It's the young people. This surprised me. I expected only people who were from Chedrin, and when I ask them questions, and I have tapes from them, beautiful tapes from a few of them, but it's
You're
hard.
Doing oral history on
Oh,
on
I have a dozen of those
Chedrin?
People, a dozen of those people, and they have precious tapes. I have it, and I, you know what I want to do with them? I want to make copies of them and turn them over to YIVO, or somebody's place where somebody will do some research on them, because these tapes are really
Absolutely.
Precious.
Absolutely, that really is. And were these mostly Pittsburghers that you were doing?
Some are Pittsburgh, some are out, but they were Chedrinners.
Right.
In addition to this group in Century Village, where I'm taping old-timers, particularly
right.
survivors, with their story. But the family, our Chedrin family, and they've been precious, because some of those people died, and then I get a letter asking, do I have a tape? And it's such a pleasure to give them a tape. It's the only
right.
voice they have.
Right. It's very special to be able to do that.
Oh, it means a lot.
Family.
And I have a series of questions which I ask, not only do I do that, but I hand these little slips of paper out to Goyim. And they to do the same with their parents. Now that's for Jewish people, and I made another one for Goyim. I once sat next to Senator Hines on an airplane coming from Washington, and I was talking about that, and I gave him that, so his aunt would do it, and he thanked me for that.
You started him on a search. All right, I think now we'll stop this tape.